case. He didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder or anything really debilitating, just a sudden realization that was hard to express without sounding trite. Zink was 25 years old, and something abstract had become real. These planes are dangerous, he thought. People die in them. The day after the B-52 fire at Grand Forks, Senator David Pryor once again introduced an amendment to a Senate bill calling for the installation of warning sirens at every Titan II launch complex. The commander of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing, Colonel Moser, had informed Pryor that at least 9 accidents or propellant leaks had occurred at Titan II missile sites in Arkansas during the previous year. At a launch complex near Heber Springs, a steel rod had fallen onto a circuit breaker, starting a fire and endangering the missile. More than 1/3 of the entire Titan II force had been patched for leaks. Pryor's amendment was co-sponsored by Senator Bob Dole, among others, but it was still opposed by the Air Force. We have a responsibility to protect the civilians living in the communities and on the farms surrounding these missile sites, Pryor said during the Senate debate. Accidents have occurred in the past, and we must take steps to reduce their recurrence and provide for the best course of action in case an accident should occur. The Air Force had recently submitted a lengthy report to the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, addressing their concerns about the safety of the Titan II. The report acknowledged that the REFCO suits and the silos communication systems could be improved. It also noted that the portable vapor detectors did a poor job of detecting fuel vapor and should be replaced. But the Air Force contended that the accident rate at Titan II sites was lower than the rate at most American workplaces, that current maintenance procedures provide a high level of safety, and that the physical condition of the missile was considered by many to be better now than when it was new. The safety record of the W-53 warhead was commendable, the report said, without mentioning that even the Pentagon thought it needed a retrofit to be safe in abnormal environments. The Air Force argued that the risk of a major propellant leak was low because the Titan II's fuel tanks and oxidizer tanks were so well maintained. Airframe rupture, the report concluded, therefore does not constitute a viable concern. The Air Force report was useful not only to the Strategic Air Command, which hoped to keep the Titan II on alert, but also to the defense contractors responsible for the missile, like Martin Marietta. They were being sued by Airman Carl Malinger and other victims of the oxidizer leak at Rock, Kansas. But the report didn't help the Air Force in the Senate. Pryor's amendment was approved on September 16, 1980, almost a year after it had first been introduced. Skip Rutherford and his wife were at home, having dinner with an old friend a couple of days later when the phone rang. Rutherford got up, took the call, and returned to the table looking white as a ghost. His wife asked what was wrong. Somebody dropped a socket in a Titan II silo near Damascus, Rutherford said. The skin of the missile has been pierced and fuel's leaking out. The guy who just called says the missile's going to explode. Rutherford phoned Senator Pryor, who was in Hot Springs, Arkansas, for the state Democratic convention, along with Governor Bill Clinton and Vice President Walter Mondale. This is serious, Rutherford told the senator. Well, how serious? They tell me it's going to explode. You're kidding me. Outside Rutherford's house, cars were driving past. Kids were playing in yards. And none of them seemed to know that a nuclear disaster might be unfolding just 50 miles away. Rutherford thought the whole thing was surreal. If the missile did explode, would the warhead detonate? Was the state of Arkansas really about to be wiped off the map? After the conversation with Senator Pryor, the phone at the house kept ringing. The calls were from other staff members, journalists, and the airmen who'd secretly been warning him about the Titan II for months. They said the missile was going to explode, and they hadn't been wrong yet. The television was on in the living room, and Rutherford noticed that a good friend of his, Frank Thomas, a 27-year-old correspondent for Channel 7, was standing across the road from the Titan II site in Damascus. He was repeating the Air Force claim that everything was under control. Rutherford picked up the phone and called Bob Steele, the news director at Channel 7. "Bob, listen to me," Rutherford said. "This is totally off the record, but you tell Frank to get the hell out of there."
"What?"
"Tell Frank to get the hell out of there. He is a friend of mine, and that missile, Bob, is going to explode."
"How do you know?"
"You have your sources, I have mine," Rutherford said, beginning to feel a little frantic. "And I'm just telling you, I'm sitting over here watching my friend Frank Thomas on your station standing right before a death trap. And I don't have a way to get to him, but you all do, and you've got to get him out of there."
Steele got the message. But Thomas was about to leave Damascus anyway.
Like hell. The outer door was a real bitch. The entrance to Launch Complex 374-7 wasn't protected by high-tech security devices, invented at a top-secret weapons lab, just by a heavy steel door with an electromagnetic lock, and it was hard to open with a crowbar. Greg Devlin and Rex Huckle took turns, one holding the flashlight, the other trying to pry the door open. Nobody had told them how to do it. There wasn't a checklist for breaking into a Titan II complex, and so the two airmen improvised. They used brute force. Devlin was in pretty good shape from boxing, but the air pack and the Refco suit made the work more difficult. Huckle felt uneasy. They'd walked beneath a thick cloud of fuel vapor to reach the access portal. Now the outer door wouldn't open. And once they got past this door, they'd have to go downstairs, break open the door in the entrapment area, and open three blast doors with a hand pump to reach the control center. All of that would have to be accomplished within half an hour. Their air packs were considered too unreliable after that point. It was about 2:05 in the morning. They were the only people on the complex. Huckle figured anything could happen and prepared himself for the worst. Devlin wasn't having dark thoughts. He just wanted to open the damn door. He felt focused and alert, ready for whatever may come. Devlin's attitude was, "Somebody's got to do this, so it might as well be me." After 15 minutes of pulling and prying, the steel door swung open. Devlin and Huckle broke through the entrapment door in about 30 seconds. They left crowbars in both door jams to prevent the doors from closing, went down the stairs.